Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 67, Triceratoping Egg Mountain.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there to get the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy or something?
Ballpark, 10 years.
It's potentially one of the things that'll end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun is the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare to our closest evolutionary relative.
Welcome to Futures in Biotech. I'm Mark Peltier. Today, we're going to go back in time, a long time. Rather than being futures of biotech, we're going to be the past of biotech. Our guest is the curator of the Museum of the Rockies and a professor at Montana State University. He is a paleontologist. Interestingly, he discovered the first dinosaur eggs in the Western Hemisphere. First evidence of dinosaur colonial nesting, first evidence of parental care among dinosaurs, and the first dinosaur embryos. He's written over 50 professional papers, 25 popular articles, co-authored six popular books, co-edited one technical book. And really interestingly, he was a technical advisor to Steven Spielberg during the making of Jurassic Park and its sequel, The Lost World. He also advised director Joe Johnston on Jurassic Park 3, three movies that I loved and sort of brought a incredible story of life history back into them and to society. It's pretty amazing stories, and they were very well told, and thank God, in large part due to our guest. His name is Dr. Jack Horner. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So let me ask you the first question. Now, as a molecular biologist, when I think about DNA, I visualize the DNA. When I think about a gene structure or a protein, I can visualize it. You know, this is part of the best way to understand it is to be able to visualize it. Physicists, when they look at equations or they think about a theorem or sort of the a rule of nature, they can see the equation in their mind. They can. It's very, very tangible. My question to you as a paleontologist, when you find a toe or a stone that might be a piece of a dinosaur, do you see that dinosaur? Does it all of a sudden hit you with great impact?
I guess so. I mean, not when I find a stone, but when I find a bone of a dinosaur that I recognize, if it is a toe bone of something that I know, like a Tyrannosaurus rex, when I'm picking it up, I certainly am imagining the animal.
Wow. So you must be able to travel in time in your mind and sort of get a sense of the greater context that this dinosaur was in.
Well, I would guess that, I can imagine a Tyrannosaurus a whole lot easier than you can imagine a strand of DNA.
I don't know. It's DNA's little simple little double helix, and the genes start with ATG, right? It's pretty straightforward. But a dinosaur requires a lot more extension let me ask you. Okay, let's start with how did you start off your career in paleontology? How does one become a paleontologist?
I think I was kind of born this way. I wanted to be a paleontologist my entire life. I found my first dinosaur fossil when I was 8. I found my first dinosaur skeleton when I was 13. I'd say I've been either an amateur or a professional paleontologist my entire life.
Were you looking?
What do you mean looking?
When you were 8 years old, were you out on Kelly's Island in Lake Erie and all of a sudden a bone sticks out? How did you come around that first dinosaur? If you could tell us about that first discovery.
My father was a sand and gravel man. He had a big gravel pit. So he was a little bit of a geologist himself. And he remembered when he was a young man riding. He had a ranch in western Montana, and he was riding his horse across the prairie. His land, and saw some big bones sticking out and out of the rock, and that's just really what happens. I mean, when we go out looking for dinosaur bones, they are literally sticking out of the rocks, sticking out of the dirt. I mean, they're real easy to find once you know what you're looking for. So at the age of 8, My father took me out to his old ranch, and I walked around and found some dinosaur bones.
Is this unique to Montana and to a handful of places in North America, or can you go pretty much anywhere in North America and look for specific dinosaurs?
Well, dinosaurs are found where the right age rock is exposed at the surface of the ground. So dinosaurs lived, you know, from 240 million years ago until 65 million years ago. And so anywhere you can go where that age rock is exposed to the surface of the ground, you can find them. But you can't go to Michigan. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of states that just don't have the right age rock exposed at the surface. Michigan, the rocks underneath all the gravel are too old. And okay. The gravel that was deposited by the glaciers is too young. Where are you right now?
We're in Cleveland. I've got a trilobite.
Cleveland is a great... Now, see, you can't find a dinosaur in Cleveland, but you can find some really great fossil fish. So, you know, if you're looking for animals, fossil animals that are... You know, maybe 300 million years old, you're in a good spot. But if you're looking for dinosaurs, T-Rexes, that are 65 million years old, you're in the wrong spot.
Okay, so I'm taking notes here. So if I go down to Tinker's Creek, where there's this erosion, very deep crevice dug by the Tinker's Creek, it exposed all kinds of sandstone. I should be in a good shape there to find some stuff, right?
No, I don't think there's anywhere in Ohio you can find dinosaur age rocks.
You could
if you go to Pennsylvania. There are some sediments in Pennsylvania, and there really aren't many in the middle. You know what we'd call the Midwest. I mean, it's just I don't live there. That's, you know, if a person's looking for dinosaurs, you come out west,
Montana.
Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, Utah. Yep.
Wow. So you started at 8, you found your first bone sticking out. You first full skeleton or first skeleton when you were 13?
It was about 50% complete skeleton of a duckbill dinosaur.
Duckbill.
Yep.
What are duckbills doing in Montana?
Well, right now they're just dead.
Right. Okay.
But 65 million years ago, they were wandering around looking for something to eat.
Okay. Before we get into sort of the biology of these dinosaurs, right? I still want to figure out how one, you know, goes out and searches. How do you prepare for it? What are you looking for? Do you go out looking for one dinosaur or another? You know, so tell me a little bit about, Your current research projects, or do your research projects kind of fall in your lap when somebody brings and says, I found this over there?
Well, I send out anywhere from 50 to 100 people during the summer. And so we do go out looking for specific things. Last summer, and in fact, over the last 12 years, we've been looking in 65 million year old rocks for Triceratops and T-Rex and other dinosaurs that particular age. Really, to find a dinosaur is pretty simple. Basically, you get your geological map that shows where different age rocks are exposed at the surface of the ground. And then you get in your pickup truck and you go there. And then you get out of your pickup truck and you literally walk around with your head down, you know, just like you're looking for money on the street. And if you're lucky, you'll find a dinosaur bone.
That must be a hell of a thrill to to be walking on the ground that is 65 million years old, and then to really cross paths with a dinosaur, especially if you've got a strong sense of their biology and their life. So when you see how do you build a story? So you find a duckbill. At that time, you know, what did you do? Did you dig it out of the ground? Did you call in some paleontologists to help you? Because at that time, I guess you're 13 years old. You know, you've got a pick and shovel. Not a whole lot of training.
When I was 13, when I found it, I excavated it for a science project, which I presented when I was a senior in high school, when I was 17. And did very well on my science project.
I can imagine. Here's a duckbill. So what kind of condition were the bones in? Maybe you could tell us what the bones really are, because, you know, we just think they're bones, but how do they last 65 million years?
Well, you know, bone is calcium phosphate or, you know, hydroxyl apatite. I mean, it's a mineral. And so it will break down over time if you just leave it on the surface. But if you cover it up, you know, cover it with sediment and leave it covered up for a long time, it will preserve. And it will go through a process called permineralization, where once the soft tissues rot out of it, out of the vessels and all that stuff are gone, then a lot of that empty space is filled by another mineral, calcium or silica or something like that, which helps, you know, to preserve it as well. That doesn't have to happen, for as you probably already know, we do actually preserve soft tissues occasionally under certain circumstances. Yes.
How far back can you go with soft tissue?
Well, we've gone close to 80 million so far.
Wait, that puts us between the 240 and 65.
Yes, it does.
Awesome. Are we talking plant or are we talking beast?
Beast. We've got, one of my former students, Mary Schweitzer, has successfully extracted blood vessels, cellular structures, heme, and collagen, the protein, from a 65 million year old dinosaur, Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Wow. Have you sequenced the proteins? Was there enough to sequence? Could you throw it under mass spec?
No, it's... It appears to be collagen. That's about all we know.
Okay. Any DNA?
No, none whatsoever. I don't think that molecule lasts that long.
Oh, man. That would be a fun one. Not even an amber?
No.
Mosquito?
No, it's just... As you, there's a better way to do it. If you're going to make a dinosaur, obviously there's a much better way to do it.
How would you do it?
Well, you would start with a bird.
Okay,
which is the dinosaur's descendant. Mm-hmm. Dinosaurs gave rise to birds.
So you know, we had David Hosler who wanted to do genome 10K, which meant sequencing the genomes of 10,000 mammals. And I suspect if you extend it, I think it was mammals. It's been a while. But then he wanted to extend it. I mean, I think it was plausible to extend it to birds as well and look at the ancestral history through the conservation of what the genome that was common to all. Do you think that would take us back to... I suppose it's very, it's not a very tangible really way to do this, but I suppose could you make a consensus sequence for a dinosaur by taking the genomes of all the dinosaurs that have ever lived, all the birds that are currently alive and go to the common ancestor? Would that take you that far back?
Well, that that I think would give us a primitive bird, but you know, there's just dinosaurs technically are birds are technically dinosaurs. So you really don't have to do anything to make a dinosaur because we already have them. But you know, aesthetically, they don't look like, you know, you look at a chicken and it doesn't look like a velociraptor. But as we all know, all of us carry ancestral genes. And every once in a while, they pop out as an atavism. Mm-hmm. So every once in a while, a human is born with a tail because the ancestral trait is still there. The gene's still there. Every once in a while, it kicks on. Mm-hmm. The same goes for birds. Birds, every once in a while, hatch out with a tail, just like we do. Every once in a while, and in fact, we use one of them, rare as hen's teeth. Every once in a while, chickens are born with teeth.
Wow.
Every once in a while, birds come out with clawed hands. So really, in order to make a dinosaur or to make something that looks like an ancient dinosaur, all we have to do is turn on those ancestral genes. In other words, find them and then turn them on. So, you know, theoretically, it's, you know, quite possible that we hatch out a chicken that has a long tail, that has hands instead of wings, and it has teeth. And it's going to look pretty close to a velociraptor without doing much of anything else.
I guess that's thinking about this. How would one fund this? But I guess a very wealthy individual could.
I don't think it's going to cost very much money to do that. I would say we could have a dino chicken with just a couple of $1 million.
Right. Definitely. Well, the
soon.
Genome's out.
And very soon. Yeah.
And I guess with chicken breeding, you know, you're always trying to expose new sets of genes for various phenotypes and shapes and sizes. So there's probably some kind of registry for strains or not strains or sort of subspecies of chickens that have been, you know, my cousin was in the 4-H club and he showed me some really funky chickens that he used to have. So that's pretty wild.
There are funky chickens. Yes, there are funky chickens, but none of them, you know, you don't see very, you know, they're not, we haven't selected for chickens with tails. And if we had, Kentucky Fried Chicken guy would have got a hold of those.
Right. Yeah. So what about the first, let's go over some of the, you know, your career of hunting dinosaurs and how it kind of helped our understanding of dinosaurs evolve, or not evolve, but our understanding evolve, not the dinosaurs. Although maybe you could tell us a little bit about that too, dinosaur evolution. So you found the first eggs in the Western Hemisphere. Was this in Montana?
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. Wow. A site we now know as Egg Mountain. It's a site in western Montana where we first found some juvenile dinosaur remains, and then as we looked around in that area, we soon found dinosaur eggs, and later we found embryos inside of those eggs. And this particular site, which we call Egg Mountain, is a very rich area for baby dinosaurs, nesting grounds, and, you know, really reveals, you know, what is possibly one of the best, you know, preserved ecosystems on Earth for what these dinosaurs were like as living social creatures. I mean, we have their nesting grounds, we have individual nests with rims around them. We find the egg clutches in them. Sometimes we find the embryos inside the eggs. Sometimes we find clutches, nests that have baby dinosaurs in them, a whole group, like a little family of babies in there. We're learning about how fast they grew. We're finding evidence of gigantic herds of them. I mean, it's quite extraordinary.
So you're finding dinosaurs, juvenile dinosaurs near eggs? Would these have been from the same cohort? Or are these from, like, Because if they're not from the same cohort, they're in a family, right?
But occasionally, when we find a nest with eggs in it, it is just a nest of eggs.
Okay.
And then in a separate nest, maybe a few feet away, we'll find maybe a group of baby dinosaurs that succumbed to something. But most of the nests were successful.
So yeah, that would be pretty rare to find a picture in time. How would that form? How would that start? Is there like a major catastrophic event that leads to like the flooding of a river shore? Or how would you all of a sudden have, these various states of dinosaur life preserved? Or is it just such a rare event, but there's enough of rare events that you can find them?
Well, in this particular case, dinosaurs are nesting on the ground. They're not, like birds nesting in a tree. So they're on the ground and they're nesting relatively near a river. People build their houses along rivers and they get flooded as well. So the flood event would not be, an extraordinary event, it's just like we see colonial birds today. Oftentimes something will happen to the parent and the babies, if they're nest bound, if they're altricial and they're not going to leave, they will just stay there and starve to death. They're not going to get out of the nest or go anywhere. So if they're abandoned, they will die and then if there's a flood, they'll be covered up. And that's really all there takes to preserve babies. But babies are very rare, which means it didn't happen very often.
I guess eggs, babies would get eaten, right?
That's right. Eggs, on the other hand, clutches of eggs are actually relatively common. And that's true, with modern birds as well. Okay, you certainly find clutches of eggs that hadn't hatched more often than you find babies that died in their nest, and it's lots of reasons for that. But we also find a lot of eggs that that hatched successfully. We find the remains of the eggs in the nest. We can tell that the babies hatched out and left and went about their business.
So in these clutches around Egg Mountain, in the nests, how big is Egg Mountain, and how dense are the nests?
Well, the Egg Mountain is a site that is, the excavated part so far is about, maybe 100 feet by 50 feet. And we find clutches of eggs or remnants of nests about every 6 to 8 feet.
Wow.
And so they're, it's colonial nesting and it's pretty, they're pretty tightly packed in there. And we've gotten lots of, this is a nesting ground of a meat eating dinosaur called Troodon, which is very closely related to birds.
How big is it?
About 8 feet long.
8 feet. Is it bipedal or is it?
Yes, bipedal. Yep.
Are all the bipedal dinosaurs meat eaters?
No. No. A lot of bipedal dinosaurs, like duckbill dinosaurs, are plant eaters. So there's quite a number of bipedal plant eaters as well.
Have you found any adult around the nest on Egg Mountain? Have you found any adult troodons?
No, we haven't. But even if you go to a modern day bird colony, it's very rare to find adult birds that have died on a nesting ground. They usually die elsewhere.
So you know that there are troodons from the babies.
Yes, that's right.
Just because then the babies, I guess you enter a huge debate. Are they troodons? And I guess, are the babies so similar to the adults? Are they really unquestionably troodons?
The teeth of troodon are unmistaking. I mean, they're very peculiar teeth, and the juveniles and adults' teeth are identical. But that is a problem with some other dinosaurs. We do have a hard time distinguishing the adults of a particular species based on juveniles. The juvenile skulls look very different than the adults. So, and that is one of my, that's one of the things I'm currently working on right now. And we're discovering that, a lot of people have named a lot of species of dinosaurs based on the fact that the juveniles do look different than the adults.
Wow. So how many dinosaurs have been discovered? And is there a catalog that we can go find online that sort of gets us through all of them? Or is there like a Wikipedia page for...
Well, I suspect there is. I haven't looked at it, but I'm sure that on Wikipedia you can find... I think there's been around 800 or 900 of them named.
Wow. I'm just amazed, right? I consider myself lucky for being able to do what I get to do, but to go out there into the field and actually walk with the dinosaurs is a pretty amazing, feat. It's just an amazing thing to do.
It's certainly fun. It's a lot of fun to be out with the dead dinosaurs. But on the other hand, it's kind of fun to hang around the animatronic dinosaurs that we created in Jurassic Park, too.
We'll get to that in a little bit. I'm still, there's so many questions about how do you understand, how do you work out their behavior, for example? But I'm still perplexed at how you can... get an understanding of what the dinosaurs, which dinosaurs they are from their bones. Perhaps let's start there. How do you know what kind of dinosaur it is? What's the first step? You dig it out of the ground. I guess if it's unclassified.
Well, there's a lot of
systematics.
You dig up a dinosaur and you got, if it's a pretty good skeleton, it at least has part of the skull so that you have some idea what it is or what it's related to. If you think you might have a new one, then there's a couple of things you have to do. You first have to compare it to things that it might be related to see if it is close enough to another one that it might be the same one and just might be, individual variation. There's also the possibility that it's an ontogenetic stage. In other words, a younger individual that doesn't look, like the adult. So you've got to determine it's what we call ontogeny, its growth stage. You might have something that looks pretty darn close to something that you already have, but then find out that, that it's at a different point in time. So, more primitive or more derived. So, there's a lot of things you have to determine in order to figure out whether you actually have a new species or not. But,
Can you age them? Because what if you,
yes.
in our time, a year is a huge amount of time, but if you're digging up dinosaurs and you get one that's 75 million years ago, and then, 20 feet later, you get one that, or further, you get one that's 85 million years ago, 10 million years is a huge time for evolution to happen, right?
Yes, it is.
And those colonies, colonial dinosaurs aren't there for 10 million years, or are they?
No, they're not.
So the morphology's changed dramatically. Humans 10 million years ago,
and in fact, we have, we can resolve down to a million years or so, and we're seeing changes over a million to a million and a half years in dinosaurs. So, yes, that makes a difference.
Have we exhausted so I guess once you get your registry of all the possible organisms that, dinosaurs, or if you're especially interested in, the reptilian class. I don't know how you'd go about it. It's such a big question here. Because there's mammals, there's arthropods, there's insects, there's trees, there's
fish. We're never going to find them all. Right, we're never going to find them all.
And it's so is the picture of our past of 200 million years ago just a small glimpse of what we could really imagine?
Exactly. It is a tiny glimpse. In fact, let me just give you a perspective.
Sure.
If you go out in Ohio, go out, wander around Ohio, and look at the places where a flood could actually cover up anything and likely keep it covered for a million years. In other words, where in Ohio do you have a depositional environment that's going to be preserved? Not likely anywhere. And that's true in Montana, and that's true in virtually all of the United States, except possibly down in southern Louisiana. Now, so we're looking, so basically all of North America right now is not going to preserve. So everything that's alive today is probably not going to preserve in our fossil record. We have a fossil record of the Pleistocene during the Ice Age because there was so much sediment that the glaciers were producing so much sediment and dumping it into the rivers, and so we have that preserved, but we're not going to get much right now, and we're not going to get much, in the next, half a million years. So at least, so our fossil record is a tiny window on the past. I mean, we just have tiny little snapshots scattered through millions and millions of years.
Well, maybe I could imagine in North America, some northern Alberta near the tar sands, if an animal dies there, that could be a good spot for, modern deposition of bones, or in a lake bed, right? Because lakes evolve themselves through it. They start off very oligotrophic, which means really crystal clear water. Then they become older lakes with more weeds and more biological deposits until the point where the sediment just overwhelms. But I guess the water is a really good place for bones to just
that's very true. But what you have to realize is that the continent is doing things, and it has more to do with the continent than it does with the lake. The lake something can die in the lake, and it can be covered up, and the lake can completely fill up with sediment. But if the Rocky Mountains or the Appalachians lift by just a foot over a million years, yep, that lake sediment's probably going to weather away. It's going to erode right out of there. It'll be gone. Okay.
So we're looking at a very small section of the biological diversity that's out there. Nevertheless, it's tremendous. You just walk down to the Cleveland Natural History Museum, and I mean, it's just amazing what they have in that one. And it must be fantastic at the Rocky Museum of the Rockies.
Well, we certainly have a lot of stuff here.
Do you guys do any Cub Scout camping in the under the dinosaurs or with the dinosaurs? That's a sidetrack.
Yeah, I think the education department has sleepovers. Yeah. a night at the museum.
He would love it. So with that in mind, how do you extend that to dinosaur behavior and physiology? Could you give us an example of some work that has led to a better understanding of behavior and physiology? Because they go kind of hand in hand.
Well, before we found Egg Mountain and the nesting grounds of Mayasaura that are near Egg Mountain, people assumed that dinosaurs were reptiles, and reptiles just abandon their eggs. They lay their eggs and they walk away from them. But what we discovered was, we found the baby dinosaurs in the nests, and we found eggs, and we found the nests close to one another, indicating colonial nesting. So basically, from this one site, we discovered that dinosaurs cared for their young, that they nested in colonies, and they took care of their young until they were at least a year old. And then they traveled in gigantic herds of, you know, 15 to 50,000 individuals. And we learned all that from one site. So
that's amazing.
Behavior. That's behavior. So 15. Now, you know, from the same animals, the same bones, basically, by looking at the growth rate, I mean, by actually taking those bones and cutting them open and looking at their internal structures, the bone histology, we're able to determine growth rates. And growth rates have to do with metabolism, and metabolism has to do with physiology. So what we discovered was that these dinosaurs hatched out of their eggs about 16 inches long and grew to 9 feet the first year. And that kind of growth rate is, you know, equal to birds. Extremely high metabolism, suggesting that dinosaurs were endotherms, that they were warm-blooded.
Wow. So that's till 9 feet long and weighing how much?
Probably 150 pounds, something like that.
And consuming enormous amounts of food.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. Dinosaurs are related to birds. And if you've ever watched birds, unless they're feeding their young, when they go out and get food for, you know, four or five babies, they don't really eat very much. You know, we have the saying, eat like a bird. Birds don't eat very much. They could process food a lot differently than I. I mean, think of a cow. A cow goes out, it eats some grass, it chews it, it swallows it, goes through a stomach, it regurgitates it, it chews it again, it swallows it again, it goes through another stomach, comes out the back, and you can still tell it ate grass.
Exactly.
Whereas a bird eats worms, or it eats berries, or it eats anything, and it comes out a little white spot.
Or a big white spot.
But the point is that the dinosaurs probably didn't have to eat very much. And you know, the reason is very simple. Mammals like ourselves, our ancestors evolved as nocturnal creatures. And in a nocturnal world, you have to generate heat and keep a constant body temperature. Otherwise, you're going to freeze to death. Mm-hmm. Dinosaurs are diurnal animals. They've evolved as diurnal animals, so they can utilize the sun. So we think that they are endothermic heterotherms, which basically means they generate heat internally just like we do, but they have a better regulation system. So think about it like this. If we fluctuate our temperature by 4 degrees, we have to go to the hospital. A bird can fluctuate their temperature by 30 degrees and they're just fine.
Really? I didn't know that.
So, you know, just like in your house, if it's warm out, you turn the heat down a little bit. You know, you don't have to feed the fire. Therefore, you don't have to eat as much.
With the super high metabolic rate as well, I mean, to maintain that, I guess there's some dinosaurs that have, Triceratops have the same metabolic rate as a T-Rex, as a Velociraptor? I mean, I guess there's a certain range as well.
Pardon?
What's the fastest dinosaur in terms of metabolism?
We have no idea. What I would just, you know, based on the bone histology, I would say a young dinosaur growing very fast.
Could they... I mean, we have heat. Our muscles can warm up pretty quick, and if we're getting chased, we can run pretty quick. Can a dinosaur, even in a cold environment, you know, shake it off and speed up its performance? I mean, I'm wondering.
Of course, birds do. Sure, certainly.
Right.
Even an alligator can do that.
That I no no. I reptiles of. I took plant physiology in college, so yeah, and switched over to stuff.
What is it? It's a what is that? There's a was it the skunk cabbage? That's a plant that actually heats up a little.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, tuna, for example, if you look at their hemoglobin,
kind of it's optimized for warmer than the water. I mean, so it's also a warm-blooded organism. So you, by looking at the bone growth rates, you can determine some physiological properties of the dinosaurs and stuff. That's what about the shape of the bones? And are there some great examples of where you're looking at the size of the brain for, and you know, the skulls of those animals that are, you know, colonial? Are they smarter than the ones that aren't? Have you found some behavioral patterns that correlate to skull size and signs of intelligence? Because some birds are brilliant and can use tools.
Well, you know, you're kind of mammal centric when you start thinking about brains, because you know we generally think that, you know, if your brain's not all in your head, then there's something's wrong with you. But you know, there's nothing to say that bird's brain is all tied up in a skull either, or that of a dinosaur, because we have enlarged ganglion in the pelvis of dinosaurs, and that may actually help a little. So when you're measuring the brain to body ratio of a mammal versus a dinosaurian reptile, then you need to take in consideration the entire length of the nerve cord. And that goes for birds as well. But when it comes to brains, you know, we don't know enough about our own brain to figure out whether size makes a difference.
I suppose. Yeah. Have you seen complex behaviors, and how would you figure those out? Besides,
well, we haven't seen complex behaviors, but we know that dinosaurs were very social, and generally social animals are relatively smart. The dinosaurs with the biggest brains are the ones that are closest to birds, like Troodon and Velociraptor and those kinds of things.
How about evolution and fossil history? Is there enough connections between the dinosaurs? I know with the more modern fossils, there's enough of them around to really piece together intermediates between species. Have you been able to find relatives in the world of dinosaurs?
Well, of course, but what, I don't know exactly what you mean by relatives. I mean, we can, you know, evolution is about generations. In other words, you know, evolution is all of the changes that we see in evolution. The biggest changes occur between one generation and the next. There's nothing that happens, you know, beyond that. So do we have every generation of every dinosaur that ever lived? No. Just like we don't have every generation of every, you know, human being that ever lived. So, you know, we don't have a, you know, the human history down very well. We've got little snapshots along the way. Same for dinosaurs. We've got, you know, dinosaurs we find in the Triassic period, some that we find in the Jurassic, some we find in the Cretaceous. And yes, we can tell who's more closely related than the other based on shared characteristics and get some idea of the family tree. But do we have all of the ancestors of every group? No, just like we don't with humans.
Let me ask you, is there an absolute consensus on how they disappeared?
I have no idea. You know, I don't care. I mean, that to me is like the least interesting question about dinosaurs there is. Dinosaurs were the dominant land animal for 140 million years, and those are the extinct ones. And now they're still a dominant animal as birds. So how and why a few big clunky ones went extinct is, to me, is just not interesting at all.
let me reverse that. What's the most interesting question being asked by paleontologists today?
Well, I don't know. There are the most. I'm looking at dinosaur ontogenies, and so are my students looking at the changes that dinosaurs undergo as they grew up. And I think that's very interesting because it does say something about their complex social behaviors. There's a lot of things we can do by collecting large samples of dinosaurs, looking at individual variation and getting some idea of you know, sort of the ecology of these animals.
Well, it must be really, really hard, right? Because it requires a tremendous amount of very careful, exploration in the field as you pull out these bones and stuff to try to answer questions such as how did these creatures interact, right? With the ontology, how would you piece together the life history of so is the troodon that is your main focus?
Well, I don't actually. One of my former students works on troodon. I would say right now I'm looking at triceratops. How does it sound?
Perfect. It fixed it. Perfect. Okay. So you were saying you're interested in triceratops right now?
Well, that's the dinosaur that we've been collecting the most of. In our business, I was interested in a duck-billed dinosaur called Edmontosaurus, and I went out to the right place to find them, hoping that I would get a whole bunch of them. And I, found very few of them, but I found a bunch of triceratops. So, that's what I work on now.
How big are they?
How big?
Yeah, and if you're studying the ontology,
the smallest ones that we get, the skulls are about a foot long, and the largest ones, the skulls are about 9 feet long.
And that, how long does it take to get to 9 feet?
Well, we're trying to figure that out. That's where their growth rate we have not figured out yet.
They must be cute at 1 foot long. That skull 1 foot long. So we're talking about a 4 or 5 foot triceratops.
Yeah, they're very cute. Big eyes, short snout. Yep, they look, they have cute features.
Yeah, and could hurt you if they're really mad.
They don't really have horns then, so.
Oh, cool. I bet they still could hurt you with a big snap. I mean, I can imagine a large snapping turtle, how much damage it could do if you really get a young triceratops angry. It could snap your bones.
Possibly.
I think we're getting a good glimpse of what it's like to work as a paleontologist and sort of explore the world of dinosaurs. I'd like to ask a little bit about what it was like and how you got involved with Jurassic Park with Steven Spielberg. How did that start? How did he, come about? Because it's not in the news, right? When somebody's making a movie, it's did he call you up? Is it, hi, I'm Steven Spielberg.
Yes, he did. But you have to realize that Michael Crichton wrote the book, and mm-hmm. his character, Alan Grant, in the book is based on me.
Right. So, I figured.
So I guess, and in the movie, Alan Grant is based on my character as well. Mm-hmm. He's from Montana, and he does what I do. So I guess that's why he called me up.
Oh, that's fantastic. And so how long did it take? How did Crichton worked with you as well to put the story together with coherence, right? Did you read his manuscripts before he put them out and made sure
The first time I met Michael Crichton was in the limousine on the way to the premiere of the movie.
Wow. That must have been quite amazing. A scientist, somebody who's been, working hard in the field, all of a sudden you're in the limelight with one of the top filmmakers of all time.
It was fun.
And did you work with the animators? You help work on the script? What was most of the time you spent with them? I mean, what did you spend most of your time on?
I was on the set whenever there were dinosaurs on the set, and I worked with the ILM to make, you know, to make the dinosaurs, the computer graphics dinosaurs. And I also worked with Stan Winston in his little creature shop to help make the animatronic dinosaurs. And then I worked with Sam Neill so he could see what a paleontologist, you know, was like.
Right. That's amazing. That's amazing. It must have been a crazy time. Well, look, I really appreciate you coming to talk to us today. I know this is a show called Futures in Biotech, and we're now looking back, you know, 150, 250 million years, and it was just an amazing journey. So thank you very much for coming on the show.
You're very welcome.
I'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Jack Horner, who's a paleontologist at and curator at the Museum of the Rockies and professor at Montana State University. I'd also like to thank our producer, Eric Lanigan, and Bert McQuinn for handling the audio and video today over in Petaluma, California. I'd like to thank Leo Laporte, Lisa Kensel, Tony Wang, Frederick Louis, Mike Taylor, John Salinina, and Ken Shepherdson, Kay Shep, for all the work they do to make Futures in Biotech possible. I'd also like to thank Phil Peltier and Will Hall for the opening and closing themes. If you guys have any suggestions, give me a call or send me an email, at mark@twit.tv. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Peltier.